Hello, everybody. I am John Allen, and this is Last Week in the Church, the show where we harvest the fruits of the last week's crop on the Vatican and Global Catholic Church beat. Here's what we've got for you this week. We begin with seamless garment. So the Vatican has issued a new document at the instruction of Pope Francis on human dignity. It amounts to a kind of greatest hits collection of this pope's social teaching, the top note of which isn't so much the individual contents, but the ensemble, the collection, the effort to combine the social justice, peace and justice teachings with bioethical pro-life teachings in one kind of comprehensive whole. We'll explain what the document said and why it might matter. Second up this week, we've got Homeward Bound. On Monday, Pope Francis met with a group of relatives of Israeli hostages who were taken by Hamas on October 7th. It was the six-month anniversary of that October 7th Hamas attack on Israel. We'll explain what the family members said, at least, that Pope Francis had to say, and why the symbolism of all of this is so important. Third up this week, we've got Taking His Time. The Pope has removed the leadership of the Vicariate of Rome, that is, his government of the Diocese of Rome, and he has indicated that he is in no particular rush to name a successor. We will talk about why it matters who runs the Diocese of Rome in the name of the Pope, and then we will blatantly speculate about when the Pope finally decides it's time to whom he might turn to take on this quite important role. Fourth up this week, we've got risky business. Why, when popes give interviews, it's always a roll of the dice, and this is something that did not start with Pope Francis, nor is it likely to end with Pope Francis. And then finally, we've got the unsinkable pontiff, how Pope Francis, despite a series of recent health scares, nevertheless, this past Friday, managed to summon the energy to get in his Ford Fiat, take a half-hour trip across Rome to address the priests of the northern region of Rome for almost 2 hours on a bewildering variety of subjects, and then made his way back to the Vatican. We'll explain what the Pope said, but more importantly, what it says about his health and his ability to continue to lead going forward. All that and more is waiting for you on this episode of Last Week in the Church. So please, for the love of God, and in the name of all the angels and saints, don't go anywhere, because I will be right back.
This is our official Last Week in the Church infomercial, because I come to you with a special offer for all of those would-be Catholic eggheads out there. That is, if you're the kind of person who likes sounding smart, who likes creating the impression that you know things other people don't, that certainly describes me. If that describes you, you're going to want to know about this. Now, I've already spoken about this new app, this new online resource called Magisterium AI. Basically, what it allows you to do is to type in a question like, what does it mean that the Pope is infallible? Or what does the Catholic Church teach about the environment? Or, you know, whatever. And it will give you a short, smart, easily digestible answer based on more than 5,000 official magisterial texts. But recently, these guys have created a new feature on the app. It's called the scholarly mode, which draws not just on official texts, but also the best and brightest of Catholic thinkers and theologians over the centuries, from Augustine and Aquinas to more contemporary figures, and will also give you a very quick answer about what those folks have had to say about what the Church teaches on various issues. Now, I promise you that if you try this once, you're going to wonder how in God's name you ever lived without it. It's brought to you by our friends at Longbeard. They are the digital marketing design company that provide the IT backbone for Crux. They provide the same service for a slew of other Catholic organizations and outfits. They're brilliant, and they are creative, and they are tremendous. And I'm kind of out of adjectives at this point, which is saying something, because I traffic in adjectives. But I am telling you, these people are the absolute level best. So check it out. This is Magisterium AI, their new scholarly mode. You're going to dig it. Magisterium.com, that is Magisterium.com. It comes with my personal guarantee.
All right, everyone, happy Wednesday to you. Happy Wednesday, April 10th in the year of our Lord, 2024. If you are a regular viewer of this program, you will note that we are not filming in our studio near Santa Maria Maggiore in Rome. Instead, we are filming from our apartment near Piazza Mazzini in a kind of Risorgimento neighborhood of Rome. You'll note behind me our wine rack. I promise you, I have not hit it in advance of this broadcast. I make no promises about what I might do once we wrap this up. Okay, so we begin this week with seamless garments. So a much-anticipated document from the Vatican's Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, led by Argentine Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, dropped on Monday, titled Dignitas Infinita, or Infinite Dignity, about... It is basically a treatise on human dignity, and it is, in a sense, a kind of compendium of the social teaching of Pope Francis over the last, well, what's now really more than a decade, 11 years, that he has been running the Catholic Church. And, I mean, it touches on a wide variety of topics. So it ranges from war and peace and the death penalty and human trafficking and the fate of migrants, and climate change, all the way to abortion, euthanasia, surrogate motherhood, gender theory, sex change operations. I mean, in other words, it's a kind of omnibus treatment of Catholic social concerns. And I think the way to think about this is a little bit like when your favorite rock band issues a greatest hits album. You're not really looking for new music, are you? Right? The whole nature of a greatest hits album is they're not putting out new tracks, generally, although sometimes they may sneak one or two new things in at the end. But generally, it's a repackaging of stuff you have already heard multiple times. So the interest isn't really novelty, right? It's what tracks they choose to include, what tracks they don't, the order in which they put them together. In other words, it is the ensemble, right? It's the collection. It is the Gestalt, to use the German term, right? It's not any individual item. And such it is, I think, with Dignitas Infinita. In an article that was published by the Vatican in tandem with the new document written by the Pope's communications director, actually, I think his title is editorial director, but it doesn't matter. His spinmeister, okay? A veteran Italian journalist by the name of Andrea Tornielli. Tornielli argued that what is distinct about this document is the way in which it attempts to overcome what has long been a kind of, split personality when it comes to Catholic social teaching. That on one side of the ledger, you have the peace and justice stuff, right? So the anti-war, the anti-death penalty, the pro-environment, you know, all of that stuff that in secular politics is perceived to lean a little bit to the left. And then on the other side of the ledger, you have the bioethical stuff. So you have the opposition to abortion, the opposition to euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide. You have opposition to birth control, opposition to gay marriage, opposition to gender theory, and all of that, all of which, in secular terms, is perceived as leaning a little bit to the right. And the truth is that although in theory, in Catholic teaching, all of this is supposed to be part of one seamless garment, right? That's the famous phrase of the late Cardinal Joseph Bernardin in the United States in reference to the seamless garment that Jesus wore, you know, during his passion. In other words, all of this is supposed to be part of one big thing. The truth of it is, sociologically, if not intellectually, the way the Catholic world works, these are often separate and distinct universes, right? You've got the peace and justice people in one camp, holding their own meetings, staging their own events, doing their own thing. You've got the pro-life people in another camp, staging their own events, holding their own meetings, doing their own thing, and never the twain shall meet. So in a way, Dignitas Infinita is not so much a contribution to Catholic teaching as it is a challenge to Catholic sociology. It's an effort to sort of to shake all of this up. To say to the peace and justice and the pro-life people that from here on out, you need to, well, play nice with each other, right? You need to kiss and make up, and you need to be part of the same team. Now, beyond that, in terms of points of specific interest, I think probably in the United States, the point that may be of greatest immediate interest is the way in which the document targets gender theory and specifically comes out against sex change operations in anything other than kind of abnormal and exceptional cases. That is, defends the idea that there is a natural biological difference between the sexes that needs to be respected in terms of public policy rather than overcome or set aside, ignored, on the basis of human choice. That would be a kind of full frontal challenge to what is a kind of very strong push in many parts of the Western world, including the United States, in favor of the idea that gender sex orientation is a kind of fluid, socially constructed concept that is a matter of personal choice. Here in Italy, I can tell you by far, the newsiest item out of this document is the challenge to surrogate motherhood, or what the Italians call utero in affitto, that is, uterus for rent, because the current conservative Italian government is attempting to promote a kind of universal ban against surrogate motherhood, which would make it illegal for Italians not merely to practice surrogate motherhood here in Italy, but also to do so abroad. So in the Italian press, the headline from this document has been the way in which the Pope appears to be backing the current conservative government under Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, at least on this issue, and appears to be opposing the main center-left party, the Democrats. One Italian newspaper headlined its coverage, Il Papa vota Meloni. The Pope is voting for Meloni, the Prime Minister. Another Italian newspaper, its headline was, Il Papa bastone il PD, that is, the Pope is beating up the Democratic Party. The lesson here, every culture will see this document through the lens of its own priorities and its own interests, because this is a kind of grab-bag document. There's a ton of content, and you can kind of choose what you want to focus on. Again, I come back to this. I think in terms of what was in the mind of the Pope and the people who prepared this document in his name, it wasn't any particular issue. It was instead the insistence that issues such as war, peace, poverty, and climate, and abortion, euthanasia, gay marriage, and surrogate motherhood belong organically together, that the effort to separate one from the other is artificial, and it's about secular politics. It's not about Catholic teaching. I think that was the point. All right, second up this week, we've got Homeward Bound, the Pope's Monday meeting with a group of relatives of the roughly 130 or so Israeli hostages who were seized by Hamas on October 7th, who still have not been released. This was a meeting to mark the six-month anniversary of that October 7th Hamas assault on Israel. I think two things of note. One, this is the second time the Pope met with a group of family members of Israeli hostages. He did so in November. But if you will remember, in November, he would only agree to meet with family members of Israeli hostages on the condition that the same day and with the same amount of time, he also met with family members of Palestinians who live on the Gaza Strip. And if you remember, that was the day in which the Pope allegedly told those Palestinian relatives, people in Gaza, that Israel was engaged in a genocide on the Gaza Strip. Now, the Vatican tried to deny that in a kind of weak way, but the Palestinians who were in the meeting insisted that's what the Pope said, and no one really ever fundamentally in any convincing way denied that. Point was, the Pope was unwilling in November to do something perceived as favorable to Israel without balancing the scales with an equal and opposite gesture in favor of the Palestinians. There was no such balancing mechanism this time. The Pope instead met with the family members of the Israeli hostages and did not have any companion meeting with Palestinians. Secondly, now after the meeting was over, the family members of the Israeli hostages held a press conference in Rome in which they said that the Pope had described Hamas, or at least the Hamas attacks on October 7th, as evil. That's the word that was employed, evil. And they said he also expressed the hope that the hostages would be released as quickly as possible and they all would be able to return home. None of this, by the way, was denied, corrected, nuanced, or watered down by any spokesperson on the part of the Vatican. So in other words, this would be perceived as a relatively clean, if you like, that is unnuanced effort by the Pope to demonstrate sensitivity to Israel and to Israelis, particularly when it comes to the hostages. Now, why was the Pope willing to do that now and not last November? Like, what accounts for the difference? Well, I think the truth of it is, in the meantime, the Vatican's fundamentally pro-Palestinian slant in all of this has become abundantly clear. I think everyone watching the situation would acknowledge that the Vatican has made it clear it does not approve of the Israeli military offensive in Gaza. It has repeatedly insisted on its support for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And it has, on many occasions, made statements, engaged in gestures that have left some Israelis and some Jews deeply dissatisfied. We've talked about that before on this program. So I think in that context, the fact that the Pope was willing to do something on Monday that was perceived as clearly an effort to demonstrate sensitivity and concern for the Israelis was an effort to net-net kind of balance the scales. Whether that will be enough ultimately to assuage Israeli and Jewish concerns remains to be seen, but you got to give the Pope credit for trying. All right, third up this week, taking his time. So the Pope, during this past week, removed Cardinal Angelo De Donatis as his vicar of Rome, that is the official responsible for running the Diocese of Rome in the Pope's name. Remember that the Pope is the Bishop of Rome. So ultimately, the Diocese of Rome is his personal diocese. However, because the Pope has much bigger responsibilities than, you know, who's going to be the parish, who's going to be the pastor of a particular parish in Rome, or, you know, what dates confirmations are going to be held this spring, or whatever. You know, he designates a prelate to govern the Diocese of Rome in his name. That official is known as the Vicar of Rome. Traditionally, it has been seen as a position of great prestige and power in the Catholic Church. Now, it wasn't so long ago that many of us thought that Cardinal Angelo De Donatis was almost the Pope's beloved elder son, like, you know, upon whom his favor rested, right? You know, the Pope had chosen De Donatis to represent him at a couple of Vatican press conferences. You know, he'd asked him to preach a Lenten retreat. I mean, he'd made his interest and his favor for De Donatis very clear. However, beginning with the COVID crisis, when De Donatis tried to shut down the churches of Rome and the Pope had to directly overturn that order, it seemed that De Donatis' favor with Pope Francis had kind of run its course. And more recently, the way that De Donatis has handled the scandal around Father Marco Rupnik, the former Jesuit who has been accused of sexual abuse by now almost 30 adult women, mostly current or former nuns, members of a religious community of which Rupnik was the patron. De Donatis, because Rupnik's base of operations has been here in Rome, in a place called the Centroletti, De Donatis was responsible initially for conducting an investigation of the Rupnik Center and seemed to give him a clean bill of health, seemed to come out strongly in favor of a presumption of Rupnik's innocence. That proved embarrassing for Pope Francis. And anyway, all of this led to the recent decision to essentially cut De Donatis loose. And by the way, this didn't come out of a clear blue sky. Last January, the Pope issued a new statute for the Vicariate of Rome, which significantly undercut the authority of the vicar, basically said he's no more than an auxiliary bishop. He doesn't really run the diocese, and he can't take any decisions of significance without my personal approval. So this was the kind of culmination of a long, kind of what you would call a slow-moving, end to De Donatis' run as a significant figure in the Catholic hierarchy. Now, the Pope recently told clergy in the Diocese of Rome that he doesn't intend to move quickly on naming a replacement to De Donatis. He wants to take his time and make sure he's got the right guy lined up. We don't know who that's going to be. Could be one of the current auxiliary bishops of Rome. That's entirely possible. And it would be in keeping with Pope Francis's style, who doesn't like to give any single figure too much power or too much visibility, because the Pope wants to make it clear that the reins of governance are, you know, are firmly in his own hands. That said, there are a couple of names that have been floated as possible candidates when the time comes. One would be Cardinal Corrado Lojudice, currently the Cardinal Archbishop of Siena, widely perceived as a Pope Francis favorite. And kind of a long shot, but it would be very interesting. Some people think it's possible that the Pope might decide to transfer Cardinal Matteo Zuppi, who is currently in Bologna, president of the Italian Bishops' Conference, might decide to transfer him to Rome as his vicar. I mean, Zuppi is a Roman, you know, by birth and by formation, so it would make a certain degree of sense. Product of the community of Sant'Egidio, kind of center-left new movement in the Catholic Church, engaged in interfaith and ecumenical dialogue and conflict resolution that was born in Rome in 1968, has its roots here. So, you know, there would be a certain sense to it. And some people think that would make Zuppi the equivalent under Francis of who Cardinal Camillo Ruini was under Pope John Paul II, kind of the all-important point of reference for all things Italian. You know, we will see. Just one indication. Yesterday, on Italian TV, when they had to interview somebody in the Catholic power structure about the Pope's meeting with family members of Israeli hostages, you know who Italian TV wanted to talk to, who was on every news channel? It wasn't Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the Pope's Secretary of State, and theoretically his top diplomat. It was Cardinal Matteo Zuppi. Now, Zuppi has no actually official warrant to engage the issues of Israel-Palestine and the Gaza Strip at all. Nevertheless, it's a reflection of the climate here, which says, you know, when it comes to troubleshooting and it comes to conflict, Zuppi really is the Pope's guy. Forget whatever the flowchart would tell you. All right, but we will see. Next up this week, risky business. So Pope Francis recently drew some blowback for an interview book he did with a Spanish journalist, Javier Martinez Brocal, with the Spanish newspaper ABC. The book is called The Successor. It's about the relationship between Francis and his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI. In it, it's been kind of described as a kind of reality TV Vatican style. The Pope kind of dishes on inner details of two different conclaves, 2005 and 2013. Also very openly, and some would say somewhat cattily, has some negative things to say about Pope Benedict's top aide, German Archbishop Georg Gainswein. Anyway, point is, there's been some controversy around this interview. Now, the only thing I want to say is that Pope Francis has given so many interviews, and they have generated so much controversy, that it is easy to believe that the controversial Pope interview is unique to this papacy. But au contraire, long thought, it is not the case at all. In fact, controversial Pope interviews have at least a 130-year-old pedigree. We can go all the way back to 1892 when Pope Leo XIII gave an interview to an atheist, socialist French journalist about the Jewish question in France, which generated all kinds of hot water and forced Vatican spokespersons to scramble to try to spin or play down what the Pope had said. We can bring this through Paul VI, John Paul II, Benedict XVI. My point is that popes, modern popes, and by modern, I mean really since the collapse of the Papal States, right? So for the last almost century and a half, modern popes have made the decision that they need to engage the press if they want to be the evangelist in chief of the Catholic Church, if they want to have what the Italians call una voce in capitolo, right? A voice in the modern conversation, then they have to engage the media. And they have all accepted that doing so creates risks because they can't control the questions that are going to be asked. They can't control the uses to which their answers are going to be put. Yet, they have all made the decision that that is a price worth paying in order to be in the mix. Now, you may say, and you may well be right, that Pope Francis does this way too much, or that Pope Francis ought to be more careful with what he says. Okay, all of that is perfectly fair fodder for intelligent debate and conversation. Just don't claim that Pope Francis invented this business of meeting the press and of rolling the dice when he does so, because other popes have done so before him, and quite frankly, I think it's an extreme long shot that he's going to be the last pope to do it. All right, finally this week, we have been talking a lot recently about papal health. We noted how during Holy Week, Pope Francis was constrained to skip his homily on Palm Sunday. Then he had to pull out of the Way of the Cross procession on the evening of Good Friday. How at various points during the big events on the Holy Week calendar, he could seem fatigued and, you know, that his bouts with bronchitis and the resulting respiratory difficulties and the problems with public speaking that all of that created seemed to continue to dog him. And all of that is true. However, if you're trying to take the temperature of papal health, like how strong is he really? What is he actually still capable of doing? I would simply offer you last Friday afternoon, when without any public announcement, without any prior warning, I mean, obviously, privately, this has worked out, but this was not announced publicly. The Pope decided that he was going to hop into the back seat of his Ford Fiat, his little blue puttering Ford Fiat that he takes when he does stuff in Rome. They pulled out of the Porta Santa Anna, that is the main entrance and exit to the Vatican. And he spent about, I'm not entirely sure, it depends on traffic, but probably about a half hour in a car, in order to reach the extreme northeastern edge of Rome, a neighborhood called Castel Monastero, or Monastery Castle, where he went to the Parroquia di Sant'Enrico, the parish of St. Henry, to meet roughly 35 priests who serve the northeastern sector of Rome, including the chaplains who serve in Rebibbia Prison, which is the largest, most important prison in Rome. And he got there at about 4 o'clock, and he stayed there until about 6 o'clock. Okay, so we're talking almost 2 hours in freewheeling, open conversation with these 35 priests. I mean, they began with a brief prayer, but other than that, it was basically, and he didn't give a prepared talk, so it was like entirely sort of Q&A. Shooting the breeze with these 35 priests. They discussed prison conditions. They discussed poverty in urban Rome. By the way, this neighborhood he went to, Castel Monastero, is known as a kind of Wild West neighborhood of Rome. It's made up almost entirely of recent immigrants to the city. It is tremendously underserved by public systems, including the police. There was a famous case a couple of years ago in which a 17-year-old girl got raped by some local gang members who then forced her to drive them in her car to her house where they proceeded to rape her mother. And on the back of that, local residents talked about how they felt abandoned by the cops. This is the neighborhood the Pope was visiting on Friday. These were the priests that he wanted to spend time with, trying to communicate, you know, his solidarity and his concern for the pastoral situation that they face. Now, my point is, look, you know, make what you want. Oh, let me point out, this was a behind-closed-door visit. The Vatican refused to issue any kind of transcript. The priests themselves clearly were sort of warned, like, you know, with threat of excommunication, not to talk about what had happened. And you can certainly, why? I mean, what's the big secret here? It is a little irritating that we don't know more about what was said in this conversation. And you could actually make a good faith argument that the people of God have a right to know what their pastors are talking about in terms of how they should best be served, because, you know, the people might think maybe we should have a voice in that too, right? It shouldn't just be the clergy sitting around hashing this stuff out. Maybe we have something to say. You can talk about all that, and it's perfectly fair and perfectly reasonable. But if we just want to put the focus solely on the Pope's kind of reservoir of strength, what he is capable of. Look, the fact that he was not only willing but able to make this trip and by all accounts be an active, engaged, principal participant in this conversation over the course of 2 hours, then drive back to the Vatican and sign off on this bombshell document that they released on Monday and prep for his meeting with Israeli hostages and get ready for his general audience, which he is doing today. All of that would suggest that this Pope, ladies and gentlemen, simply is not on his last legs. I would suggest there was still some gas left in the papal tank. How much? God only knows, but there's some. All right, that is our show for this week. As ever, you can find full coverage of all these stories on the Crux site. That is cruxnow.com. I will be back here next week, same bat time, same bat channel. In the meantime, have a fantastic and blessed week. Stay safe, stay healthy, and I will talk to you again very soon.